in regards to the homeless situation, please get involved in the struggle. Please take a stand. Please get rid of your fear as effectively as possible. Yes, we are all going to die. I've heard people say that, oh, I might not make it out of here alive. That's the truth for all of us. Nobody's going to live forever. So the question is, are you going to live for yourself, or are you going to live for the people of the world? That's a fundamental question that we all have to ask. I've made up my mind. Please make up yours. Take care.
Hello, Robert.
Hey there. I'm talking to Just Man Jim. Yes. How you doing, Jim? Jim is drinking on the job. Just quaffing down all that H2O here. It's pretty disgusting. You're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM.
Have a good show.
All right, Jim. See you later. This is Bathrobes Pier Robert Norse, your host for the next 2 hours. We got a couple of co-hosts coming in, as you heard Jim say. We got Beggarbacker Becky Johnson and Dragonsart Dan Hopkins, and who knows who else. We're hoping to get a phone call from Santa Barbara, where protest Bob Hansen and cobblestone Colin Atherton will be calling in. These are folks who've been with the homeless rights movement for 2 decades. They are both homeless themselves and regularly employed, one as a performer and panhandler, the other as a carpenter. That's Bob Hansen. Bob was been around Santa Barbara when homeless activism was at its height down there, and the city council actually repealed that city's sleeping ban, as you've heard me talk about in the past. So we're going to have a little genuine sleep out music in a moment. And this next show we're having here today, Bathrobes, Piers, Broadsides, the show that's coming up, we're going to actually be giving you kind of a sampler, a smorgasbord of interviews. I'm hoping that we can persuade Phil Free and Bob Duran and others who control the nighttime airwaves to let us do some loop time late at night so you can actually hear these interviews in full. I'm going to play kind of brief samplers from a number of interviews and then ask you to call in and say what you want to hear most, and then we'll try to arrange to have that played in the wee hours of the morning in full when there's more time, with, of course, the permission, if we can get it, of those moguls of the late-night airwaves.
Babble and cry for attention.
What you're hearing in the background now is music at City Hall from 2 nights ago. We had a trio of guitarists show up. They were regaling us with their own brand of late-night intoxication. This is what it is. I'm going to keep on talking in the fashion of some talk show hosts. Dealing with the real shelter crisis. He was claiming that he was. It wasn't enough. merely a political protest. It was more a human reality. People needed a place to be, so they chose City Center Plaza Park. And that was a tense evening on for many weeks. And it was supported by an organization called Food Not Bombs, which around the clock served food in a 24-hour soup kitchen on the sidewalk.
Thank you, Mr. Spencer.
In the park, not blocking the sidewalk.
And now,
anyway, Agnos got together
perhaps,
an injunction claimed that Food Not Bombs could not serve without appropriate permits. And after much hassle, they got the appropriate permits, only to find the entire permit process was removed by the Parks and Rec Department in 1990. The second injunction was issued, and Food Not Bombs suffered over 1,100 arrests, which I was three or four of those. One of those arrests, I said, take me to trial. And to my surprise, they did. They convicted me in February of 1994 of serving free food, serving rice and bagels. I was sentenced to 2 months in jail. We appealed that case all the way up to the California Supreme Court, which this February of 1996 sent back the case for me to go to jail. So I was due to present myself today, 2 hours ago, in San Francisco, to be jailed for 2 months, or hopefully, as my attorney's been arguing for you here a little bit about this today, the modification downward of the sentence was, after all, when the enlightened, Willie Brown, mayor of the San Francisco in January of this year, his new program, supposedly homeless people no longer being arrested for sleeping. He said that on February 22nd, no more arrests for sleeping, no more arrests for victims of crimes of this sort. Homeless crimes, lifestyle crimes. The Matrix program is over, quote Willie Brown. Indeed, tickets not only under the Jordan administration, but 3,800 were kicked out of court by on the motion of this victim. Very encouraging. I mean, the amnesty we really need here in San Francisco is proclaimed in San Francisco, but that hasn't stopped them from continuing to harass and to arrest people in San Francisco. We're still waiting to have that shoe drop. And hopefully, that part of Brown's promise be kept. So that's still in the cards, and I was going to ask the court, since they've stopped the arrests of two people, since they're no longer dumping buckets of broth in the sewer as they were doing before. They had no finding of any health hazards. They just got this injunction they were armed with. The Georgians just get the food out of town and arrest anybody who stops them from doing that program. So I was due to show up for a sentence modification. District Attorney Terrence Hallinan was going to speak. And Hallinan, who was 45 years member, can't see the whites of your eyes. For the last 5 years, he actually served soup with me. I say, man, you gotta get some company. Rest. The show is solidarity. Wake up in a better light. So that's great. And we're hoping to do that in the future. But unfortunately, the judge who's going to hear my case, Judge Tang, she has decided she does not want to hear the case. It's too political for her. So they're kicking it back into more medieval court. The original judge who found me guilty in the first place is Judge Robert Bumbuster Barclay. And Barclay is going to have his horse and pony show probably on the 8th or the 16th. We're not sure which, because the date depends on when we can get District Attorney Terrence Hallinan to attend. So we were going to have a caravan this morning at 6:30, and we had to call it off yesterday on rather short notice. And for those of you who showed up, found no caravan, or for those of you who got to San Francisco and found no demonstration, my apologies. I wish we'd had more time.
True.
Wish we'd had more time to bring this information to you, and unfortunately we have not, and it's all been really kind of makeshift. But there will be a hearing. I do face jail. In fact, it's become more likely now that it's going back into the original court, and I'll be giving you updates on that, and probably I'm preparing to go to jail for, I figure, at least 40 days, unless we get the judge to agree to a modification of sentence downward without conditions. I will not agree, for example, to probation. I will not agree not to serve food. I will not agree not to protest. I will not agree to obey all laws, and that should be explained. The reason for that is if you agree to a prohibition to obey all laws, which is part of probation, you, in essence, forego your right to a jury trial on potential convictions. You can actually be seized if you're put on probation, even if it's a relatively mild court probation. And they can jail you not just for the 2 months that you have been sentenced to, but for the entire, they can sentence you to a longer period. I believe that's my understanding. I think that's true, actually. Yeah, that's right. It rarely happens. People who take probation, court probation, as for example in nuclear protest cases, don't usually violate it. Though a former food server, Brian Flanagan Staley, who was the first man convicted of serving free food in Santa Cruz in February and March of 1989, he took probation, and then when he realized he wanted to do some protesting with Lockheed, he asked the judge to violate his probation so he could do that, and he went to jail and served 2 or 3 weeks, as did local food and homeless activist Sandra Loringer, or Sly Shoes Sandy, as I used to call her. So anyway, do keep listening to this station, to my program, which airs twice weekly, Mondays and Fridays, 10 to 12, and you'll get the news on when I'm going to be doing this next caravan, when we're going to be going up to San Francisco to support not just me and my right to serve free food, not just Food Not Bombs' right to serve free food. We're looking for an end to the Matrix program in San Francisco, an end to anti-homeless laws in California that penalize the poor, an end to our local sleeping ban. We want to lift the injunction against Food Not Bombs in San Francisco, stop the harassment in Arcata and Whittier and other places, and get back at least to square one, where we can recognize that people who are faced with misfortune and so find themselves on the streets, or who make the choice to have an alternate lifestyle and so are different in that regard than others, but not engaging in violent or abusive criminal behavior, should not be treated as pariahs and should not be discriminated against in the name of gentrification in our modern cities, in the name of the profit system. So the phone number here is 427-3772. In the studio, we have with us two guests, and we're hoping to get a phone call from the Santa Barbara activists, I said, who are thinking of a march. They're thinking of a march that would be a small version of a much bigger march that these women and men did in 1988. They marched across the country. After the sleeping ban was ended in Santa Barbara, they decided to take their message on the road. And in 1988, January, February, they started out in a caravan, and they walked all the way across the country to Washington, D.C., stopping every night to camp. Mostly illegally, I might add. And I think they only had like one arrest. It was quite a tale, and perhaps they'll tell it to us if they call in. Anyway, they're proposing that we do a similar march here in Santa Cruz. I was thinking of a very small march, like a week's march up to San Francisco, where we go through San Jose and Palo Alto, Mountain View, all these little cities that many of them have instituted new anti-homeless laws. I believe Santa Clara now has a law against signs, people holding signs up on the freeway, or perhaps it's a panhandling law. I sometimes get these guys confused, and it is mostly guys that pass these laws, though it has to be said that our city council has a majority of women, and three of them are as reactionary as they come: Cynthia Matthews, Mary Beth Campbell, and Jane Yokoyama on at least the basic issue of the right to sleep at night in Santa Cruz, which apparently they can't agree to. It's okay for if you got a house to sleep, but if you haven't got a house, well, we'll wait till you have affordable housing, and then you'll be allowed to sleep at night. So, as I said, we have these folks protest Bob Hansen and Cobblestone Colin Atherton calling in to have a conference with Dan Hopkins, if he can stay awake. That guy is always snoozing on the job. The guy he's got some sort of narcolepsy. We can't understand why he's always falling asleep. The reason he falls asleep is because most of his time he has to stay awake in the wee hours of the morning to warn the other protesters if the police are coming, so they can wake up and hopefully uncover themselves with blankets so they do not become technically illegal and subject to yet another of the over 100 and... Is it 120 tickets now, Dan?
Yeah, 120 today.
Oh, there were tickets today? Well, listen, maybe you better come in here and give us the update. I mean, let's get all the excitement as to what happened last night. Why don't you join us? Join us in the studio here. We're going to be talking now to Dragon's Heart Dan Hopkins, who is first a resident of the Coral Street Open Air Shelter. He's a juggler, performer, He's a protester for peace. For many years, I guess he was protesting against the Iraqi, the Bush genocide in Iraq back in 1991, and where you met our old grand old man of protesting, Wanton Dave Jacobs. That's the mic, folks. So, hi, Dan.
Hi, how you doing this morning? Well, last night, about 5 o'clock in the morning, four police officers came up. Sergeant Clark was leading them, and normally on his days working, he makes sure that everybody gets tickets. So there was five people given tickets last night. The interesting thing about it is one person had blankets around him and a sleeping bag, and he was not given a ticket. Also, one person was taken to jail because he didn't have an ID card. Now, this was his first ticket of sleeping. But because he didn't have any ID, he was taken to jail. He'll probably be kept for the whole weekend plus a couple of days extra, because the weekends don't count on the jail, you know. And the guy kept saying, "You mean I'm being taken to jail just for not having ID?" And the police officer said, "Yeah, you're going to jail because you don't have ID."
You know, it's interesting you should say that, Dan, because people who have been in past sleepouts, and there have been many of them, I would say thousands now, if you want to look at the last decade of sleepouts in Santa Cruz, I've never heard of a ticket for not having ID. I've heard of a ticket for failing to identify yourself where there is a suspicion of false information, which is a misdemeanor, like if you're trying to avoid prosecution. But I've never heard of a ticket for not having an ID card, because that, supposedly in the United States, as we saw if you read today's San Francisco Chronicle, they passed a bill against immigrants, but they specifically stated there shall not be a national ID card. Because one of the concerns about people in a democracy is that you shouldn't have to identify who you are to a police officer just because she or he asks you. You know, if you're charged with a crime, then you have to identify who you are. But just because you're moving from one place to another in a public place, or you're sitting around, that's one thing. Now, I suppose you say, well, these people are charged with a crime of sleeping. And I suppose that in a certain sense that's true. And even though you do have to identify yourself, it's been my experience in Santa Cruz that you simply have to state your name and address. You do not have to prove who you are. You don't have to whip out your papers as you would, let's say, in Nazi Germany, Stalinist Russia, Deng Xiaoping's China, I don't know, whatever is going on in some of the little dictatorships in Africa and South America. You are innocent until proven guilty in the Anglo-American system of jurisprudence. And as such, you have no obligation to the police to prove who you are. But in several interviews with Michael Rotkin, mayor of Santa Cruz, he has not only defended the taking of blankets as evidence, though recently he stated that that was a mistake. Taking of blankets as evidence, of course, is a preposterous idea when you have a modern invention called the camera, and you can simply take a photograph. It's obviously an attempt to punish and penalize this, and Rotkin then further said, well, they don't take blankets from homeless people sleeping in other places, just from the protesters. So it's only if you're trying to exert your First Amendment rights that it's okay to take a blanket. I mean, Rotkin obviously got a Z in civil liberties. I mean, I don't know what he's teaching up there on the hill. And we suddenly have let me just finish this one sentence, then we have an emergency announcement, or an exciting announcement, I'm not sure which, from Judgment Day John Stewart.
Your first 10 minutes were utterly unintelligible, thanks to the background music being higher than your voice. That's the first 10 minutes, and I've been ringing the phone for the last 15 minutes, and you're not answering. I don't know what's wrong with the phone.
There's nothing wrong with the phone. It's the guy who's on the phone. That's me. The ringer has just been turned on, folks. So if you've been trying to reach us on the phone and you've been getting tired of hearing garble on the air, so we have a lost 10 minutes. I'm going to have to kind of repeat a few items. Thank you, John.
You owe me.
I owe John Stewart, and I'd like to apologize to my audience for that garbled minutes. If you've been trying to reach me, the ringer is now on. We are at 427-3772. It's too bad, because those two songs are actually not bad songs. I was trying to do the Bob Duran thing, which not too well. I've got to learn how to keep the volume way down on the music, I guess, when I'm talking. Anyway, what Dan was talking about, don't go away, Dan, I want to get you back here. What we were discussing with respect to Mayor Rotkin was, Rotkin has said recently that, oh, you know, the demonstration, they take away signs from the demonstration, the police do, but that's because they're litter. They're all litter. That's what he's told by the police chief, of course, and it's not true. The signs are simply provocative of the police, because they don't like the issue and they don't like the people being there in the first place. At least that's my interpretation. But Rodkin has also said, and that's what this long blah blah is all about, that if they don't have adequate ID, they'll be arrested. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know if Mike has simply abandoned his ACLU membership. He's decided to, join the National Socialist Party. I'm not sure what his plan is, or whether he simply just decided civil liberties is a passe issue with respect to homeless people. But you do not have to have an ID. If you are arrested, you do not have to have an ID. If you are in fact lying about who you are, then that's criminal behavior. If the police suspect you are lying and they want to charge you with that, then they can arrest you. But this idea of arresting someone because they don't have ID, even if they're charged with a minor infraction, has never been justified, and has not been the policy, as far as I know, of the Santa Cruz Police Department. It sounds like Rodkin is setting it up as the policy. He's preparing the way for the new order with these kinds of new explanations. And it's really kind of frightening.
Yeah, when Ben got arrested today, for not having ID, and they said, well, can't you prove who you are? And he said, no. He says, I'm a citizen of the earth, or something to that effect. Cop said, well, we have to take you in.
Which cop?
I don't remember the guy's name. But anyway, the interesting thing about that is that there was two other people who didn't have ID and didn't have to show their ID to the cops. And they just gave them tickets, but they didn't take them to jail. Yeah, they knew who they were.
Right.
Yeah, Sunshine and
Ben's been around
and Jimmy.
Ben,
no, yeah, they do know Ben, actually, because they've known him from other instances downtown, because he has that musical instrument that he plays, it's a didgeridoo, and so the police know him pretty well, because he blows on that once in a while in places where they don't like him to blow it, and make noise and things. So anyway, he's in jail. He's probably going to be in jail for the whole weekend, like I said earlier, I don't know if that was broadcast or not, but so anyway, we're up to 120, and right across the street from City Hall, there's a person who sleeps every single day right out in plain sight. There's also another person who sleeps in the front door of the library every single day, and right straight across the street, which is no more than probably 24 feet across,
The police are selectively enforcing the law. They are ticketing. They're not ticketing those people, and they are refusing not to ticket you. They are ticketing you,
right, to speak.
They should be applying a single standard and not ticketing everybody, it would seem to me. Otherwise, they're selectively going after protesters, which is wrong. Well, what I was saying at the beginning of the show, and I want to move on John Stewart's information that the first 10 minutes of the show is just sheer garble. Boy, that's depressing. It means that the people who are trying to call from Santa Barbara have not been able to get through either. I hope they keep trying. Maybe they will. What I said at the beginning of the show is I want to apologize to folks for the slow information on the change in the demonstration. Did anybody show up today at 6:30 in the morning for the caravan, Dan?
Yeah, actually Chris did. Yeah.
Chris Brosden.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Well, thank you, Chris, for showing up. I appreciate that. The information that we got late yesterday or midday yesterday was that the Food Not Bombs sentence modification hearing for my 2-month jail sentence for serving free food in violation of a court order in San Francisco, that had been postponed because the Judge Tang up there thought it was a little too political for her and was kicking it back into the court of the more medieval judge, what's his name? It's not Barker, Bailey?
Barkley.
You see, I'm becoming apprehensive of even saying his name. It's the jailhouse blues are beginning to start creep. They're coming after me. So anyway, we said that this will be happening probably on the 8th or the 16th of the next few weeks. And we will let you know. You can stay tuned to this station. You can give a call to 423-HUFF, 423-4833, to get information on when the next caravan, when the next court date will be. And there's actually going to be a demonstration on the 8th at City Hall in San Francisco on Van Ness. It's the new City Hall. The old one is under, I guess, modification, some sort of earthquake redesigning and so forth, against Mayor Brown's refusal to keep his word on the Matrix program. And that'll be at noon on May 8th, Wednesday, May 8th. And I believe we're going to have a caravan going up on that day if we can find somebody with a vehicle, like Becky Johnson, perhaps. Becky, are you interested in doing a caravan on May 8th up to City Hall to support the Matrix, Let's End the Matrix demo?
Yeah, I'm trying to put that together both with my own vehicle and then solicit other vehicle owners and or operators to get involved and bring some people up.
So if you have a vehicle, give a call to 423-HUFF and think you want to show up. It would be probably around 9 o'clock on a Wednesday morning next week, May 8th.
Well, it'll be nice if we know for sure it's May 8th when we get the thing locked in.
That is locked in. There is a demonstration at noon on May 8th, and that's going to be independent of whether I will be going to my hearing. Will probably actually be on the 16th. But for those who want to support a program to end the Matrix, and that's the demonstration we're talking about. So you may not be interested in going to that one, I don't know, but it is a program that all of us oppose. The Matrix is the most virulent, vicious, and overt form of what's happening here in Santa Cruz. We have our own anti-homeless laws, and Matrix, of course, is sort of what, it's the high-profile version. It's the dragon that has to be slain, and Dragon's Heart Dan is probably the man to do it. As are other people like Beggar Buster Becky and, of course, Bathrobes Pierre Robert, yours truly, the host. We are on Free Radio Santa Cruz. This is 96.3 FM. We hope we are intelligible. If we're not, please call in. The ringer is on, and you can put us through the ringer. You can also talk and tell us what you think. And, hey, there's an incoming call.
Hi there. You're on Free Radio Santa Cruz.
You're coming through good, Robert.
All right. Thank you, John.
Bye.
Appreciate it.
I'm glad someone is listening out there. My thanks to our one listener, Judgment Day John. Hey, one voice in the darkness. So, Becky, you've been following the newspapers. You've been issuing press releases for example, that unfortunate Sean Alimi, or Shit Kicker Sean, as I call him. He's certainly getting a lot of shit kicked his way, no question about it. You want to tell us what's been happening with Sean Alimi?
Okay, well, I've been trying to sort this story out, and one thing that I heard, and we're still trying to verify if this is true, Sean apparently went through down to the courthouse. He was trying to find out where his hearing was, and he went through all the processes. May called all the numbers, asked all the people, looked on the sheets on the door, couldn't find it anywhere. They said, oh, I guess, you know, the charges have been dropped, and weren't too surprised about that. That's been happening quite a bit lately. Then, when he goes up to his next hearing, the judge says, oh, you didn't show up for your previous hearing, and so therefore you're a poor risk to be released on your own recognizance, and so now he sits in jail. This is kind of bizarre.
Yeah, I think that's consonant with what he told me by phone. He's called me a couple times from jail, where he is now sitting. He's been there since, I think, Monday morning. Is that right, Dan? Sean has been jailed since Monday morning?
Yes,
sir. And he's been on hunger strike since, what, Tuesday morning?
Yeah.
Protesting his incarceration. He also has been, you know, led into court in his cute little pajamas, that the humiliating outfits that they all wear.
I was under the impression that the hunger strike was specifically aimed at the camping ban laws.
Dan, what's the hunger strike aimed at from...
That's what I heard.
So Sean is now doing a hunger strike from jail to protest the camping ban law. He also mentioned to me he was concerned about illegal treatment that he was suffering. And then again, the specifics here seem to be that he attempted to meet court date, and he's been doing that pretty diligently. Judge Salazar issued a failure to appear warrant on April 19th. He was... he was arrested on Monday.
I think there's a lot of credence to this, because when we were doing some support work and calling down to the courts and trying to find out when the hearings were happening, in whose court, what time, we were given such a runaround. I'm not sure whether they just don't have their act together down at the courthouse as far as having an efficient method for distributing this information, or whether there is some purposeful obfuscation of this information. So it may just make it difficult for the people to show up at these hearings in a timely manner, and for their support persons also to show up there.
Yeah, that's always the question. I think mostly they're just, you know, bureaucratic bungling going on. I don't think they actually have it enough together to even be conspiratorial about this. But he's in jail. This is like his fifth or sixth jailing. And again, what is he being jailed for? Well, this warrant had to do with an overzealous bailiff named Thurber, who I actually have sued in small claims court, who arrested me falsely, essentially because he wanted to assert his authority. And, you know, the charges were dismissed against me, so I took him to small claims court, and I couldn't get a judgment against him for various reasons. But in my opinion, he was guilty, no question. He's sort of a little twit, frankly, is one way to put it. He's sort of an uptight little guy who, you know, gets his jollies by going after homeless activists in court when he sees them. I guess he doesn't like them. Anyway,
maybe it's the
twit. It could be, and I don't think Thurber is calling in. That could be somebody else, though. Let's hope that, don't hang up here.
Hi there, you're on Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Pete, the people's seen Sean Leamy is May 10th, next court date.
That's, I think it's May 9th, but I could be wrong. I was
May 9th at what time?
Oh, I was told it was May 9th at, I'm not sure. I think it's either 8:30 or 10. And for those who want to work through the labyrinth of the court processes, you can call them up alternately. Actually, I may have that information with me. I'll look for it. I think I have it here in the file, Chris, somewhere. I'm going to try to find it.
What does Becky happen to have the number there to the courts to who to call? Because usually you get recordings. And then you get a series of recordings when you call the county.
I hear you. I don't know. Chris, Becky's asking if you have the number for the court.
And then I'm wondering, because I was in Barton's court. That was the day before the Sixth Circuit heard Ed Fry's and other arguments to the visiting court of appeals. I was in court there. Barton kept all six or seven homeless waiting at the end of the docket. Alimi was at the end of the orange jumper suited people.
Mm-hmm.
So it appeared we were purposefully kept waiting unnecessarily 4 or 5 hours when all that the defense wanted to do was to argue a continuance to demur on the constitutionality of the sleeping ban. I wonder what he was arrested, according to Sandy I heard on the radio, for trespassing in a public place.
Actually, I've found
true?
I found the document. Yeah, the first of all, the court date is May 9th, and it's at 10 o'clock in Department 1. He has had the case transferred out of Barton's court, Barracuda Barton, as I called it, into Kangaroo Kelly's court.
I heard that, and he was not present during that transfer. His defense attorney, that was after the courtroom.
Christine Carter is his defense attorney.
Right. She disqualified him under a 170.6.
And that, for those of us who don't know, is a motion to your one peremptory challenge of a judge,
one peremptory without cause challenge, or is that the...
Right.
Okay, well, then apparently it is possible to disqualify a commissioner any day of the week, including blue moons, without using up your one peremptory no cause.
Well, that's a good question. I don't know if that's true. I actually asked that question of the clerk.
All subsequent action in the trial is a mistrial if that's not known and not accurate.
Well, I understand you say that, Chris, but when I went down to discuss it with the clerks in the basement of the county building and specifically went to the supervisor, the clerks, said, isn't there another procedure for demanding a trial before a judge? They said there's no such procedure unless it's a misdemeanor. You can demand a trial before a judge if it's a misdemeanor, but in an infraction case, you can't. And so actually, in Sean's case, that's quite appropriate, although I think Sean disqualified Barton for all his cases, not just for his... The one case that we're talking about that Sean had was he was in the basement of the county building trying to get his court dates, trying to disqualify one of the prejudice referee, John Mad Dog Mulligan, as I call him, and he had a lot of cases to disqualify. This was in early April. And he went through an entire number of cases, and the people at the window reportedly told him, look, we got all these other people in line, you'll have to come back later. And he said, no, I've been waiting in line. I've got these cases, I'm sorry, it's not my fault that I'm here, I have to do this. And they said, well, could you come back later? And he said, yes, if you'll put me in line where I was before, if I can come directly up to the window to do it. And they said, no, we can't guarantee that, although, of course, they could. They could have said, sure, come on back. But for some reason, they didn't want to do that. I think they were being bureaucratic and petty, and they made a mistake there.
I think they were purposely trying to frustrate him and
Probably.
They did then arrest him for failing to...
Well, they called a bailiff in, and the bailiff said, get out of here. And he said, no, I'm going to stay right here. And he said, arrest me.
At the window? He waited in line, came to the window.
Yeah, he waited.
They refused to serve him, and then they arrested him.
And then eventually he was arrested.
For trespassing in public?
He was arrested for what is called interfering with business, where the business has to do with... I read the law is a longer law. It states, if you interfere with a public agency, some crap like this. Anyway, so he was arrested, and he was immediately released at the jail, apparently. By his report, they thought it was crap, and they released him O.R. immediately. And we filed a complaint about Thurber. I've still been trying to hear from the sheriff's department on old complaints I have on this bailiff who arrested him, Thurber. And apparently, this is the case that he did not show up for, they claim, although he says he did. He said he went to three different windows on April 25th to look for this case, couldn't find it. And as a consequence, he was seized the next time they arrested him at the sleep vigil, next time they ticketed him. And he's been in jail since Monday, and he's been on hunger strike since Tuesday. And he is still in jail, presumably losing weight. Maybe not. Maybe he's sneaking in cookies. Who knows? But, it's people who have gone to jail in the past have done hunger strikes against the sleeping band.
He says after he was arrested, he did go to the window again, or...
Well, he was arrested on April 4th.
I mean, that's intimidating.
Wait a minute. Let me ask the question. On April 4th, he was arrested, and he was released. And then on April, I believe it was either the 19th or the 25th, he went there. He went to the window looking for his court date, and he couldn't find no record of his court date. So anyway, they claim that he didn't come. They claim that he wasn't in court, blah, blah, blah. So anyway, he's in jail. But the important thing is he wanted to present evidence to this effect before Judge Barton. Before Judge Kelly. And Kelly, because that was to whom his case was transferred, refused him an opportunity and said, come back on May 9th. So apparently for Kelly, rather than pull out a file, he'd rather wait until and keep the guy in jail for another week at taxpayer expense. So I think Kangaroo Kelly is hopping in the wrong direction on this one.
Well, he's just been assigned after the disqualification.
But he had the option to continue the case for a day and then have him reappear on the calendar the next day. And again, and in fact, Sean did reappear on the calendar.
Well, he has the right to a bail hearing, I believe, within 3 days of...
He has $1,000 bail. The bail was set already.
$1,000. But he has a right...
$1,060.
He has a right to reconsideration of a bail hearing, doesn't he?
I don't know.
Yeah. Well, it's set then, but you can...
Well, let me ask you about your case, Chris. You yourself had a little confrontation with referee Mulligan and Mulligan's bailiff about that same time, didn't you?
A confrontation? We had a dialogue that was interrupted by a bailiff. I believe it was the same bailiff that arrested Thurber, and I was ejected from the courtroom. The judge, Mulligan, I was chewing up a tape that was not empty to record the disqualification, since it's a question of whether you can disqualify a commissioner without using up your one peremptory challenge.
Uh-huh.
Flory told me that Mulligan does not believe you can. I believe Salazar says you can, and I'm not sure about Kelsey, and apparently Barton did allow it. So, anyway, bailiff came over and said, you can't, is that recording? I said, no. And the judge told me, instructed me to hand the radio to the bailiff, and I did.
In the tape recorder?
Yeah, tape recorder. And I said, I'm queuing up a tape. Can I just queue up a tape? I'd like to get this recorded at the segment that I, a non-empty segment. I mean, an empty segment. And he instructed me to hand the radio to the bailiff. Mm-hmm. And,
anyway,
what happened then?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I have to be careful because this is on tape. This is all previous on tape, and anybody who has to help you transcribe it.
Well, perhaps. Well, perhaps you don't want to.
I'd like to because it was petty in that he demanded that I not tape the disqualification on a non-empty tape, mm-hmm, that I required to use a new tape. This is a requirement. I said, is there any law under which this is required? And he said, I don't know, which is honest, thank you. And then somebody ran out, one of Nikki's friends ran out, got me a blank tape. And then there was a little question of whether I could hold the blank tape, given that I've already given him our tape recorder. Why can't I hold the blank tape? What nonsense is that? Are they so afraid that I'm going to put some kind of a segment in there or manipulate tape or something? I mean... That's possible for anybody to do. What are they paranoid about? Or what are they falsely afraid of? Or what are they afraid of? Anyway, I got arrested because I hesitated. I said, I wanted to tape it myself. I get arrested. The judge said, you can wait outside. And I turned counterclockwise and left. And outside, I was arrested.
For?
Well, then I had paper on me that I didn't want them to seize. And the Flory says the bailiff grabbed me by the neck. I don't even remember that. And I threw him the bag. And two other bailiffs came down and arrested me.
It was football in the hall with your papers.
There's no resistance. I thought I might begin a civil disobedience, as I've been delinquent to do much there at the camp out by refusing to move my body for the bailiffs. They had transferred me back and forth between the stairwell of the court and the holding cell, right around from the corner of the evidence room, apparently where all that dope is.
Well, what were you charged with, Chris?
Oh, what was I charged with was, well, luckily it was only five contempts, five separate contempts, each with 6 months, 2.5 years sentence facing Monday.
Five charges of contempt?
Yeah, five, only five from a single incident. You know, it wasn't 10 or 15.
And who will be hearing this case?
It's ridiculous that they could charge me with 2.5 years, even formally.
Sounds excessive.
For hesitating over whether or not to hand the bailiff the tape, and I wanted to be in the courtroom, and I said, okay, here's the tape. And I was willing to give up the blank tape.
Chris,
after they did me, yeah.
When is this all happening?
Oh, Monday sometime, 8:30 or 9:30.
And whose court?
I don't know who's got it. I'd have to look.
Okay, now do you have a public defender?
Not at the point, not at present.
Now, this is an arraignment on these charges.
This is an arraignment, yeah.
Okay, so are you going to keep us advised as to what's going on? Do you want people to come and attend this hearing?
I'd like to head off the arraignment. Which is a way to do that, probably right.
I don't know how to do that, but I know that that we could tell people that it's happening.
Because invited me to a custody hearing, a last final dispositional at the 1 year. When I showed up, they gave me an attorney. They gave me a new attorney, you know, not the 10-year former associate of the district attorney who with personal animus prosecuted me.
Well, look, before we go into that,
yeah.
I'm trying to get a time and a date for your hearing in
court.
No,
I'm not certain. I'd have to look at my papers.
But why don't you, when you do get that, why don't you call in perhaps maybe Dan Hopkins' show this afternoon at 2 or Johnny Dredd's show at 4 or my show on Monday, and although maybe too late on Monday because it may be...
They falsely illegally shut me out of a hearing in which I was entitled to an attorney on a custody matter, and a closed door in my face.
This is a previous hearing.
Yeah, this was just like Friday.
On Friday?
Yeah.
On Friday...
That should be appealed.
A week ago.
Absolutely appealed out of that court.
Right, well, let's take them one at a time so people can clarify what's going on.
Why the contempts are suspicious, because it's...
Let's have people come to your...
Pressurizing.
Sure, they're suspicious. They're bullshit. Have them...
I was on the way out of the court. The judge says, you can wait outside. He didn't say, you go outside.
Chris, yeah. You're repeating yourself.
Right.
And I acknowledge that's what you were doing,
okay.
And you've already said that.
Right.
But let's have people come to this hearing. So call 2 o'clock today during Dan's show. Tell him, you know, get your paperwork in order. Let us hear what's going on. How we can support you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Oops, sorry about that, folks. That was Crossroads Chris Brazda, who's often written for both statewide and local homeless people on issues that are of importance to us, including international issues. He's facing contempt of court problems on Monday, and we're facing another phone call.
Hi, you're on Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Just listening to your stories of Mad Dog Mulligan.
Oh, yes, Mad Dog. Actually, I have called him Mad Dog, but he's more like Meat Grinder Mulligan. That was Robert Flory's suggestion, because he tends to turn out sentences like sausage one after another.
Yeah, I know what you mean. After 8 times of getting disqualifications for tickets around town, the last time he just, like, decided that was enough, and he was going to give it to me regardless of what I got.
Oh, really? Who are we talking to? Are you an anonymous caller?
Well, yeah, I don't want to go back in again.
But you have a right to disqualify Mulligan whether he likes it or not. You know that, don't you?
Oh, I know that, but it's a cycle. You know, you can fight him all day long, but it's just turning up your time, and it doesn't do anything for them. They'll just put another guy in after he's dead, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, two things I wanted to point out is the homeless issue. One of the things, the word's wrong.
Uh-huh.
The word should be shelterless. We're all homeless. We are all homeless in this country. Mm-hmm. But a few of us are shelterless. You know what I'm saying? As the minute you say homeless, it turns into a sentimental issue.
Well,
you know what I'm saying?
I hear you.
Christmas time, everyone starts crying. Oh. Right, you know? But if you say shelterless, it makes people think about what the difference is.
Well, there people. Some say roofless, some say shelterless, some say houseless, some say urban nomads. Yeah, it depends on who you're
homeless,
talking to.
Home assumes like that everybody else has something that you don't. And I don't think it's necessarily true.
Or some say landless. You know, I mean, it's interesting. Well, the point of the homeless thing is that it all is a way of saying that the most elementary, basic comforts are being denied you because of often through no fault of your own.
Oh, that part, yeah.
That's the impact of homeless.
So. The other question I guess I have real quick is, what is the possibility of the so-called homeless, shelterless, whatever, becoming, really moving as a campaign or together to become jurors?
Jurors?
Yeah, because here we are, they know more about the court system, they'd love to be sequestered.
You mean become jurors as in an official, as part of the county mechanism?
Of course.
Well, the way you become a juror is, as I understand it, you register to vote, and then the jurors' lists are taken off the voters' list. So, presumably,
license records.
So it's only people who are official.
It used to only be voter registration, but they found there were a lot of people who purposely didn't register to vote because they didn't want to get summoned for jury duty.
Good.
And that was considered a bad thing. And so now they do take a certain percentage from driver's licenses. So now, I guess if you don't want to get summoned, you have to not register to vote and don't get a driver's license. But your point is very interesting.
I mean, with jury nullification and the volunteer service, why not?
Traditionally, poor people and homeless people have a much lower registration rate as far as registering to vote,
right?
Which is the main way to get on to be picked for as a juror. And this has gone through the courts, and it's been tested that homeless people can register to vote. I mean,
that's right.
They have to put down where they sleep. And if they sleep, I sleep past the third rock on the right, if they write that down, that's considered legal for registration purposes.
So as a movement to get some political power back, becoming jurors is the way to go.
Becoming jurors, and I agree with you to a great degree.
That's the solution to me, and then jury nullification is the next step.
There's another step I'd like to suggest, and that is that people educate themselves on what their rights are as jurors and be informed jurors, because a lot of times when people do jury duty, they have to rely on the judge's instructions.
Right, there it goes out the window.
All right, and if they came in with some previous knowledge, that would greatly enhance the power of the jury.
You know what happens every time the jury nullification people stand outside of a courtroom? They get arrested or shoved away, you know?
Right, so we need a much bigger education program on educating jurors on their rights as jurors, what they can and can't do, and I think we need to do better as far as registering voters of poor people and homeless people.
Well, if you had that as the issue for registration, not the fact that they were cynical and apathetic and they wouldn't have their vote didn't mean anything, but that they might have a presence on a jury, on a mm-hmm. judge that used to, as a regular, route them out the door.
Oh, yeah, one person could be very powerful on a jury.
Well, they're changing the law now, and that's very. Mm-hmm. That's why I bring this up about the 11-to-1 hung jury thing.
Right.
They want to throw out the hung jury. It's a possibility, and that's
well
all
taken.
You need.
I'm handing you back to Robert.
Okay, well, I don't have much more to say, but I just thought it was a way to do some political action without a lot of, you don't have to unify around a big issue other than you got your voice.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So that's an idea from Free Radio Santa Cruz audience there. Thank you, caller. The problem with a jury's idea, which is a good one, is that you can get dumped from jury panels by those who think you are likely to be sympathetic to the defendant, and that can frequently happen if you're, you know, if your homeless background is revealed, if you're on the jury. Not that you shouldn't continue to try, you should, but don't have any false illusions about what's likely to happen. Oh, I promised a smorgasbord of interviews, and that's what I'm going to do, but before I do, I'm going to have our talk show co-host here, Beggarbacker Becky. You've got some, so you've been kind of surveying the Sentinel, and you've got some sort of broader comments about local public issues, actually national public issues that affect homeless people, certainly, but that also affect the broader audience you wanted to bring up. Could you briefly do that?
Well, I was rather interested in the Sentinel article yesterday and today. This is really switching gears here. The report from the Center for Disease Control about their campaign for public education regarding AIDS. And they've come across saying something that it's an issue that's concerned me for years. And that is that back in 1987, the Center for Disease Control started this broad public education program with the theme, "Anyone Can Get AIDS," which is technically true, but it was disingenuous. And so I was much surprised to read in the Sentinel on Thursday, May 2nd, that the statement that for most heterosexuals, the risk from a single act of sex was smaller than the risk of ever getting hit by lightning. The article goes on to say that campaign by the government agencies is more than dishonest. It also is having a perverse and potentially deadly effect on funding for AIDS prevention. For instance, though homosexuals and intravenous drug users now account for 83% of all AIDS cases reported in the United States, the federal AIDS prevention budget includes no specific allocations for lesbians and gays and IV drug users. This was followed up, there's several articles on Thursday. It was followed up by the editorial in today's paper, where the title of it says "New Direction Needed for AIDS Education," and so they talked about the recent program. But distinctly missing from the editorial was any mention of a clean needle exchange program. They do say here, it says you could add to that intravenous drug users as a high risk group. Well, what do you do about intravenous drug users? You could say, oh, that's a nasty habit. You stop doing that. All you heroin addicts and out there, just stop doing it. You could say that, and it probably would not work. But what you could do is provide clean needles. Study after study has been done to show that when such programs exist, it does not bring new people coming down like, oh, I always wanted to be a heroin addict, but I was always afraid I'd have to use a dirty needle, so therefore I won't use this drug. I mean, that like never happens. Oh my goodness, I need a little more time here, Robert.
Oh,
yes, I haven't even gotten to the anal sex part. You'll probably perk up when I get to that part. You know, I know. Yeah, the CDC and a lot of these so-called AIDS educators, I sometimes think they're miseducators because they're spreading so much disinformation, have been influenced by a hardcore religious right movement, which has seized upon the incidence of AIDS in our society as a way of saying, see, we told you that you should be monogamous and celibate before marriage and monogamous in marriage. This is, you know, what more proof do you need? And so you can see that this is not truly the case here. What was missing, let's say, back to the editorial today, it says that meanwhile, scientists say thousands of infections could be prevented each year if only the message were directed to the right people. But the editorial in the Sentinel does not mention what that message is, and I can say it in like two sentences what that message is that would probably, if it were followed, would probably prevent somewhere around 95% of new transmission cases. And that is, perk up, Robert, if you're going to have anal sex, whether you're a man or a woman, and whether your partner is a man or a woman, use a condom. Is it tremendously more important to use a condom during anal sex than vaginal sex? And secondly,
what do you do with anal personalities who don't have sex?
Oh, well, I don't know. That's a much more difficult problem
they
to remedy.
Condos to condoms, I'm afraid, yes.
And the second thing is, if you're going to shoot up, use a clean needle. We desperately need a needle exchange program. That was not mentioned in the Sentinel article. I wonder why. And also, although, you know, there's a lot of talk about AIDS transmission among gay men because of the practice of anal sex, what is never mentioned is that heterosexuals can have anal sex, and that a lot of the transmission, the so-called heterosexual transmission of this virus, is from heterosexual couples having anal sex. Again, the message is the same. Use a condom. Thank you.
So all you fuck-happy people out there, let's take those words to heart, or to groin at least, and straighten up your act, particularly if you're into anal sex or needles. This has been a lengthy public service announcement from your local Bathrobes Pier and a beggar-backer Becky here. We had promised to give you a smorgasbord of tapes, and we're hoping to go through a number of them. One is, our first tape is going to be from the National Center on Law and Poverty, where we got some information on cities where they don't make it illegal to sleep outside. Thank you very much. Are you leaving for good, or are you coming back? We hope that our host will be returning soon with still more updates. Okay. Well, perhaps we've seen the last of you, at least for the moment. We have interviews from Santa Barbara, from the activists there. The call-in that we'd hoped for has not yet come. We have interviews from the Community Homeless Alliance in San Jose. We have lots of interviews from SHAC, Stanford Homeless Action Coalition, that Dan Hopkins, Charlie Phillips, and I went up to visit on, I guess it was Wednesday. Very interesting discussions of what's happening in Atlanta, Georgia, for the upcoming Olympics, anti-homeless activity in Palo Alto, and the homeless response. We have an interview with Kate Wells on Lisa Ann's latest adventures. Lisa Ann, you may remember, was a woman who has had two kids stolen from her by Child Protective Services, and now, apparently, they're about to try to steal her liberty. She was assaulted on the levee after she attempted to defend Cloud, her partner, who is being attacked by Officer Seeley, not Sergeant Seeley, but the younger Officer Seeley, according to Attorney Kate Wells. Well, that interview as well. We have a Coalition on Homelessness interview this morning with Bobby Joyce. Bobby Joyce is the lead plaintiff in the Joyce case, which challenged the Matrix in San Francisco. We need a lot of things, too, by the way, and we're not just going to throw it at you free here. We're going to try to guilt trip you a bit. We're trying to do a history of the sleeping ban and investigate some of the original voters on that issue back in 1978. Two of those are Councilwomen Charlotte Melville and I think her name is Carla De Palma. I may have the first name wrong. In any case, Shasta, a man who's doing a documentary on the sleeping ban, has been interviewing Michael Rotkin and myself, and is hopefully going to investigate the situation even further. And we'd love to have some help from you around this. If you want to help in investigating these matters, give me a call at 423-HUFF, 423-4833. We're also looking for people who want to kind of go out and do contacts in other communities, either by phone, by letter, or by visiting, to kind of link up homeless struggles in different areas. That was one of the reasons we went to Palo Alto on Wednesday.
For those who are interested, City on a Hill, this issue has a lengthy article on the hosts, and for once it's actually a pretty good article, which means I agree with it. Naturally, they quote me, but they also have Mayor Mike Rotkin. Something is Rotkin in the state of Santa Cruz, no question, perhaps a little too much. And they give you his justification for the host program, which, by the way, has been expanded to $100,000 a year thanks to the votes of our fine city council. I'm not quite sure what the vote was. I'm not sure if Celia Scott voted against it or not. Put in a call to Catherine Byers, a council person this morning, try to get some information. That hasn't happened yet. We're also looking for graphic artists. I am anyway, not just for this program, but for people from the Common Thread Coalition that Dan Hopkins is the lead person on. And Dan, you've been doing some serious leafleting and petitioning down at the vigil. Isn't that true? You've been getting lots of phone number signups. Now we need somebody to get on the phone and actually call those people, because apparently our main food source, or your main food source, Sean Alimi, is in the lockup on hunger strike, of all things. Yeah. And of course, this is a fellow we talked about earlier, Sean, jailed numerous times for sleeping. He and Dan Hopkins started this whole vigil 65 days ago in front of City Hall.
Yeah, we got about 600 signatures right now, and we really haven't tried that much during the demonstration because we've been so sleepy and everything, but we did have somebody that volunteered to get some signatures off the mall, and he was able to get about 400 of the signatures in no time flat, you know, in just a couple of days, I guess. And I'm done.
Well, I think what I was trying to do is encourage people to volunteer to help, not just... See, the signatures, as I continue to point out, are not important at all. The city council couldn't care less if you have 50,000 signatures, really. Maybe they might look at 50,000 signatures, I don't know. But what we can use, however, are phone numbers of people who actually are interested in helping. And some of these people who gave signatures also gave phone numbers. And we need volunteers to call those phone numbers and encourage people to volunteer so we can actually get a real support group around the City Hall sleepout. Now, if you have some spare time and you're listening and want to help change the law, stop that, that makes it illegal for people to sleep in Santa Cruz or to play with strange rattling puzzles during airtime, which is what I'm trying to spank Dan for doing, give a call to 423-4833. That's my phone number, or the Common Thread Coalition. What's that number, Dan?
It's 421-9250.
Repeat that for me.
421-9250.
And that's also the number for the Revolutionary Coalition.
Yes, it is. He's taking all the telephone calls for the Common Thread Coalition. We have about six or seven organizations now that seem to be coming around, you know, especially at the demonstration that we had on Saturday, I think it was. And so we're looking for any other community organizations that want to join up with us. Just call 421-9250.
So while you're rushing to the phone to call one of those two numbers, 423-HUFF and
421-9250,
you can hear a little bit of the national homeless scene. Here's an interview with the National Conference on Law and Poverty.
Speaking again to who?
Maria Foscarinas.
Maria Foscarinas. Maria, this is Robert Norris calling from Free Radio Santa Cruz in Santa Cruz, California. Hi.
Hi.
I got your name from Celine Marie Pascal,
mm-hmm.
who apparently spoke to you last week.
Uh-huh.
And she said you had some encouraging news for homeless people, us particularly, because in Santa Cruz we are, I'm not homeless myself, but some of my friends are fighting a sleeping ban. They're in the 60th uh-huh. day of a sleep out in front of Santa Cruz City Hall. And I heard the word that Atlanta has changed its law regarding the right to sleep at night for poor people.
You heard that from?
From Celine, who said she heard it from you.
Huh.
So maybe not. And I may, well, it could be just a rumor. Uh-oh.
Yeah. She may not have gotten it quite right. I didn't actually speak to her about this, but I know she got our report.
Mm-hmm.
We've monitored.
Can you hold for just a moment?
Sure.
Maria. Yeah.
Okay. Hang on for a second.
Sure. While you're looking for that Atlanta statute, have you had any updates on what's happening in Miami under the...
Just give me a sec, okay?
Sure.
Talk and read at the same time.
Oh, sorry.
I haven't quite mastered that.
No, that's okay. Some of us love to do three things at once, you know.
Right. what she must have been talking about.
Okay, what's
and
that?
And that's from one of our reports.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, it's a couple years old. But there was an effort by advocates in Atlanta to get the city to repeal a prohibition on sleeping on park benches.
Mm-hmm.
And that was successful in October of 1993.
So it's legal to sleep on park benches in Atlanta.
Right.
But is it legal to sleep at night in Atlanta on park benches, I guess, is really the question.
Yeah. Well, maybe not. That's a different question.
Mm-hmm. Do you know of any cities? Mayor Mike Rutkin of Santa Cruz has challenged me to find one city in the United States where it's legal for homeless people to sleep at night in the urban area.
Mm-hmm.
Can you think of any, or what's your reaction to that?
Let me give you, let's just back up for a second. Mm-hmm. Tell me what is happening in Santa Cruz, and I'll tell you what's happening nationally.
Okay, well, what's happening in Santa Cruz is, in 1978, they, for the first time, included the word sleeping in their ban on camping and made it cover much private as well as all public property.
Okay.
So it's illegal for people to sleep outdoors between 11 and 8:30 in Santa Cruz, or to cover up with blankets when not asleep. On any public property or any private property or in any car unless it's a fenced-in side yard or a backyard or unless they're in part of a three-vehicle program in a church parking lot.
So this is the ordinance that has been on the books since 78?
Correct.
Something happened recently?
What's happened recently is the Winter Armory shelter has closed, the only legal campground in the area, and actually in the country that we know of, unless you know of other legal campgrounds for the homeless. The Coral Street Open Air Shelter is closed, and Santa Cruz is facing a situation where it's 500 to 1,500 homeless are illegal.
So is there a stepped up effort to enforce the ordinance?
No, there's not, except against the protesters at City Hall who are getting, I've got over 100 tickets. So.
Okay. Well, what you're describing is illustrates a national trend.
Mm-hmm.
Cities around the country are stepping up their efforts to make it a crime for homeless people to be anywhere in public,
mm-hmm.
essentially make it a crime to be homeless. And this type of law you're describing is fairly typical. In other words, a prohibition on sleeping in public,
mm-hmm.
or camping, you know, the addition of the language about a cover,
mm-hmm.
is another typical type of city law.
Mm-hmm.
And what's happening is cities are passing laws like this. They're also increasing their enforcement of existing laws,
mm-hmm.
Where they've been on the books. Now, there are also a number of these efforts have been challenged in courts around the country, in federal courts typically.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell us about a couple of those challenges?
Yeah. In Miami, Florida, there was a constitutional challenge to something similar to what you're describing, where the court ruled that it was unconstitutional to ban necessary life activities like sleeping in public,
mm-hmm.
when there was simply no alternative place to perform them.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, when you can show that, in fact, there's no other place for people to be,
mm-hmm.
then it violates the Constitution to make it a crime for them to sleep in public or to perform other essential activities.
We would hope so, wouldn't we?
Excuse me?
We would hope so.
Yeah, well, mm-hmm. believe it or not, this has been a difficult and controversial argument to make, and the Miami case was the first court or major court ruling recently to hold that.
1991 or so? Or
92.
And did Miami respond by allowing people to sleep in public?
Well, yeah. I mean, what happened was the court ordered the city to create some safe zones. So those are parts of the city where people can sleep without being arrested.
And did Miami do that?
Yes, but this is still, I mean, it's still in litigation.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're still trying to avoid it.
Mm-hmm. But as of now, Miami is a city where homeless people do have supposedly safe zones where they can sleep.
Right.
By court order.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Same kind of challenge in Dallas,
mm-hmm.
More recently, challenging that city's anti-sleeping law. Federal court struck that down on constitutional grounds.
Wow.
So
is it possible you can send me a copy of that, or...
I can have someone send it to you.
I think you're going to send me your report, which I'd love to get, and I can also
try
to do that.
You actually want these what's your I understood you had a short timeline.
I have a short... I'm going to use your interview on the air in about half an hour.
Okay.
And I'm going to use these documents later to do more extensive research for future shows.
Great,
I do a twice-weekly show.
You need to have it. That would be great.
And that was Maria... Maria Fasarinas of the National Conference on Law and Poverty. That's the first possible tape you should let us know here at the studio if you're interested in hearing more of that particular interview, and we will be playing that hopefully on a loop tape later. Here's another goodie for you from Stanford Housing Action Coalition. The big point with Maria's interview, which was confirmed, by the way, when I talked to attorney Harry Simon, lead counsel for the Tobe case here in California. Tobe was a case that was originally very positive, where they threw out, the judges threw out the camping ban in Santa Ana, and then the California Supreme Court turned around and dumped that decision, making us all feel quite sad. But Simon has been really on top of the whole thing. He's worked for the Legal Aid Center down in Southern California for a long time. He confirmed that in Miami, it is still there are still safe sleep zones. So if Mike Rotkin wants an example of a city where it's legal to sleep, he can look at Miami. He might give the mayor a call. So, Mike, if you're listening, pick up the phone and check out how things are in Miami. Or maybe you just look out your window and see how things are in Santa Cruz. There's another possibility. Here's something from Stanford Housing Action Coalition. Wednesday night, they were doing different seminars and speak-outs on criminalization of poverty, being poor.
Criminalization and homelessness workshop.
Thanks to everybody for coming. This is going to be very loose. We want this to be very discussion-oriented, and we're not going to... I mean, there's going to be parts where we're presenting, but it's not going to be a lecture, so... I mean, this is very... We hope this to be participatory, so... With that, I guess.
Okay. What we thought to do is first start off by talking about what criminalization of poverty means on a kind of a general, general level, and then talk about two case studies and two places that where we can talk about the specifics of what criminalization of poverty means now, and the other is here in Palo Alto. I think one of the things we wanted to start off by talking about is that, I guess just breaking down, what does it mean, like criminalizing poor people? Why is this happening? Why is there a move in this country towards criminalizing poor people? And then what does that look like, and how does that take place? And I think the first thing, you know, the most obvious way in which that's happening is through laws that are being passed, right? Which make certain activities, survival activities, for homeless people illegal, such as panhandling, or sleeping on a park bench, or in Atlanta, I guess I could speak more clearly about being in a parking lot, being in a vacant building, washing a car window, these kinds of things, which folks need in order to either live, just to be out at the places where people are, or things in order to make money, such as washing a car window or asking for spare change, right? So there's the laws, and then do you want to talk a little about selective enforcement and what that means? Before I do that, another way in which the law is used is the law is changed. When laws are created and then laws are changed, in Palo Alto and numerous other places, it's popular to change the law so that it provides for the complete leveling of public restrooms, for one thing. Another way it can be changed is by removing park benches, which happened along University Avenue. Another way is changing zoning ordinances. There was a place that was designated for housing, and rather than providing the housing, they just changed what it was zoned for, and then you're done with it. Because you can pretty much say, once they've zoned it, rezoned it, they're like, well, we can't zone it back again. And so that those are other ways in which laws are changed to accommodate the present mood. And in enforcement, that was the other thing we wanted to talk about, is the laws can be created and changed, but also selectively enforced. And laws that are seeming to be pretty harmless, like jaywalking, the enforcement aspect of the law can be used again to criminalize people. The other thing, like a lot of these laws that are on the books, actually that more and more cities are starting to pass, actually duplicate a lot of laws which are already existing, but with the new focus being on actually targeting homeless people, such as like panhandling laws. Like there tend to already be laws in most cities that, you know, make any sort of aggressive or violent behavior illegal, and that panhandling, these aggressive panhandling laws only do the same thing, but with tagging on the panhandling, which makes it easier for a cop to then go out and arrest somebody who might just be asking for spare change and then can interpret it, you know, in any sort of way. Then there's also a move towards criminalizing activists and allies of homeless people, such as in San Francisco, Food Not Bombs. That kind of enforcement is happening simultaneous with homeless people themselves being the victims or the targets of police harassment. And
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
And it seems that your case study really kind of brings a lot of it together, because I mean, it talks about creation of laws, but also enforcement of when. Like, that's another aspect of enforcement, is not, it's not only how they're enforced, but when. And at certain times, it's been shown that enforcement and targeting increases. Right.
By the way, we're experiencing that now presently on another aspect in Santa Cruz over drumming, which now they're having a meeting tonight, actually, in Loudon Nelson. And
that was Charlie Phillips and two other student speakers talking about criminalization of poverty with Stanford Homeless Action Coalition last Wednesday. We have a much longer, in fact, we have several hours of tape on that whole issue. We'd be happy to play for you if I can find time, we being me and whoever else is willing to put on the tape. This is the second possible tape you can hear. Again, you should kind of decide which of these you're most interested in and leave me your ideas at 423-HUFF. Give a call to 423-HUFF to call in which of these tapes you find most interesting, and these, I will hope, will be played in full some later time. Next, you're going to hear an interview with someone locally in Santa Cruz, Matt Smith, who is with Dayton Food Not Bombs, and who has also been recently helping the City Hall sleep out.
At Cannabis HQ, talking to Scott
Immler. Rather, this is an interview with Scott Immler and Ed Fry at Cannabis HQ here, the Cannabis Club. Shortly after yesterday's Scott Hager hearing, we'll also be hearing the interview with Matt Smith of Dayton Food Not Bombs in a moment, but here's a bit of the Immler-Fry interview.
Recently, remuneratively employed cannabis worker here, just up from L.A. What's happening, Scott, on the marijuana initiative?
It'll be on, look for it, November 5th, 1996.
So it has made the ballot?
Yeah. The decision hasn't come out of the Secretary of State yet, but we know, because we cleaned up the signatures, we know that we have enough to qualify, more than enough. We filed 775,000 last Wednesday.
Excellent. And enough to make a large donation to free radio as well.
Right. We're gonna try and find a new donated home for you.
Cool, man. All right.
Our contribution to Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Now, we're in the same room here as...
I'll lend you my classified ads.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Scott. You're in the presence of the attorney who defended Scott Hager. Did you see that court proceeding or hear about it?
Yeah,
what was
there.
Your opinion of this man's performance? Did he botch the job again?
No, he did an excellent job. We're proud to have him as medical marijuana's attorney.
Even with that haircut?
Even with that haircut.
You should say that to him.
Well, there you have it. Now we'll get an interview from the horse's mouth itself. There you go. Exactly. And that's from...
Hey, that's from me. So what are you going to do about it?
Yeah. Well, this is the kind of anarchistic activity that goes on around here. Everybody's talking at the same time.
Okay.
So who's this person? Speak up.
Chad,
you're having a shake there. Well, I'm gonna go interview him.
Thanks. Not that kind of shake.
No, not that kind of shake. Okay.
Bye.
So, bye-bye. Welcome back to town. That exciting introduction. I'm, in fact, in the office, the law office of Ed Fry, attorney at law and official counsel, designated counsel for Scott Hager after a weary day at the Court of Appeals, which for the first time in some time has actually made its way to Santa Cruz to hear the issue of... what issue did it here today? Ed Fry.
Have you paid your fees?
Radio interview, Mr. Fry.
What was the question again?
The question was, what issue was the Court of Appeals considering, and can you give us a sort of summary of what happened? Give us some of the exotic highlights. I understand that People who attempted to do extended media coverage were told to hit the road. But nonetheless, we do have a tape of this thing, or rather a pathetic tape, I might add. But
yeah, the First Amendment took it in the shorts again today.
Give us details.
Becky Johnson filed a formal request to film the, videotape the proceeding. Mm-hmm. They rejected it without giving any reason, except to say that, well, you should have requested it over a week ago.
Which just sounds highly unusual to me. I've never heard of an extended media request being required more than 24 hours in advance anyway. Usually it's at the time of the hearing itself.
Right. That I thought was very uncool. But the hearing itself, the arguments were pretty interesting and lively. The judges were all pretty interested in the issue of medical marijuana. And it sounds as if they just, well, might have an open mind about the issue. And we challenged the medical marijuana prohibition by saying that the first of, Article 1, Section 1 of the California Constitution gives the right of privacy and the right of safety, right to pursue and obtain privacy, pursue and obtain safety. And both of those rights are, in our opinion, very clearly give the right to patients to use medical marijuana when their doctors recommend it. And the judges gave me a hard time, but on the other hand, they also gave the Attorney General a hard time when he made his opposition argument. But I thought that I detected a real interest on the part of the judges to look seriously at this issue and possibly even rule for the patients. Who knows? I mean, there is a... I'm more hopeful now than I was before the hearing, because this particular panel of the 6th Appellate District, this three-judge panel... Whose names are Judge Primo, Judge Elia, and Judge Wunderlich, is the same panel of judges who granted the injunction in favor of the Stanford athletes who were challenging the NCAA's right to give them, administer P-tests for drugs.
P-tests being piss tests? Or?
Yeah. So that, because the judges said, well, in our opinion, the right of privacy in the California Constitution prohibits NCAA from doing that because it's too much of an invasion.
And that was eventually overturned by a higher court?
Exactly. This California Supreme Court overturned them. But this is the same panel, and they're back again on another privacy issue, also involving drugs, but this one much more compelling than, some track star from Stanford who doesn't want to show his weenie to the monitor,
And much more influential and widely applicable.
Right, right. So I think the judges are going to look at it objectively, which... is more than most people get, I think. I think, in general, judges tend to act out the interests of those who appoint them, such as Governor Wilson and all the corporate money behind him.
And these three were, in fact, appointed by Governor Wilson?
No, I think Primo was appointed in 1988. I think that would have made him a Duke Magian appointee.
Mm-hmm. Or Jerk Magian, as I call him.
Right.
You're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz. Some tasty samplers of interviews that we intend to play at length if you choose you want to hear them. If you think you want to hear more of this interview, give a call to 423-4833, and I'll try to line it up for another time and then announce that time on my next show so you can hear the complete interview. We actually have literally hours of interviews that I think are worth playing on the air, and I hope to line up a time to play them on the air. Now we have an incoming call.
You're on Free Radio Santa Cruz.
How you doing?
All right.
Bob Hansen from Santa Barbara.
Bob Hansen from Santa Barbara. I'm glad you got through. Were you having trouble getting through before?
Yeah, I tried about 10 o'clock, a little after 10, and I kept getting busy.
Ah.
You guys are really busy up there.
We were very busy, and actually we had the, I think it was either the phone off the hook or the ringer was screwed up. I appreciate your trying again. Unfortunately, the people you were going to talk to, the guy is taken off, but maybe we can still talk to you. Maybe some people are listening to you on the radio. Bob, you're, longtime homeless activist in Santa Barbara. You struggled to humanize the sleeping ban down there in 1986. You're a carpenter. You're a public speaker. You've run for mayor many times. You've been arrested many, many times. In fact, you're known as Protest Bob.
Right.
And you actually were part of a caravan across the country in 1988. What was that march called? What was it all about?
It was the homeless and poor people's peace march to Washington, D.C., just to bring awareness that they're not talking about that issue, you know, during the presidential race. So we were trying to, you know, keep the issue alive. And so we walked about 15 miles a day, started in Santa Barbara on Martin Luther King's birthday, January 15th, and arrived just the day before the election in Washington, D.C.
And do you think that had much impact? Were you hassled as you went across the country? Were there arrests for illegal sleeping and things of that sort?
No, they treated us with kid gloves. I think that the people that saw us saw that we were, you know, doing something, which I think they appreciated. We always had money in our kitty. You know, people who came forward and helped us out all the way along. We picked up aluminum cans. I think, you know, it was worth it. It, you know, kept the issue alive, and I think people saw that we wanted to, you know, do something for the people that, without homes in America.
How many of you were there on this caravan?
Well, there was roughly about 15 of us all the way across. You know, some people would come and go and this and that. And
men, women, and children?
Yeah, there was about three or four children off and on, and there was about three ladies off and on, and then there were some older people that were up in their 60s and younger people down in their, you know, 20s, and so, you know, most of the people were semi-young, you know, under 30, and we had our, you know, disagreements and stuff, but it was, you know, it was a successful walk. And
you literally walked across the country?
Right. It took us about 9.5 months.
Wow. And you called this march?
The Homeless and Poor People's Peace March to Washington, D.C.
And indeed, it was. This was 2 years after the "Come to the Fig Tree, Go to Sleep, Go to Jail" campaign resulted in an end, at least in some areas, to the city's sleeping ban in Santa Barbara.
Yeah, somewhat, but still, they. As soon as the meeting was over, they started creeping back on to you know, erase some of the stuff. And even just yesterday, a friend and myself, Cobblestone Colin and myself, talked to Sandra Lasager, who is the city administrator who runs the city. And she said, no, you can't sleep on this proof property. We go, well, isn't that the intention? I just talked to the mayor 2 weeks ago, and she said you can have your bedroll in which you can feasibly carry with yourself and sleep on unimproved city property. So she denied it, and then about 5 minutes into the conversation, she said, well, if it's not posted, you know, so if it's posted, you can't, which would be, you know, fire hazard or closed from 10 at night until 6 in the morning.
You know, actually, what you're talking about now is the current situation in Santa
right.
Barbara, and what I was referring
okay.
to is the situation in 1986, when, in fact, for 3 years, as I understand it, from 86 to 89, with the exception of the parks and the beaches, it was legal to sleep on public property, whether developed or undeveloped, in Santa Barbara, when they ended that sleeping provision of the sleeping ban. Is that accurate?
Yeah, but still, they immediately started putting signs up in a lot of the public places, like around City Hall or buildings down by the beach, and so just like even this, you know, talking about unimproved city property, they posted. So as we talked to her yesterday, we were saying, hey, you can feasibly have your bedroll in which you can carry with you. She goes, yes, that's, you know, so it's not considered camping. So they're trying to define camping.
That is, in fact, Bob, what we're trying to do here in Santa Cruz is get the law changed so that the act of sleeping itself is not illegal, the act of covering up with blankets is not illegal, and carrying, you know, your possessions with you in a blanket and a sleeping bag is not evidence of, quote, camping. But we can't get the mayor to even look at this, Mayor Mike Rodkin, because he says that if the law were changed, everybody and his mother would come to Santa Cruz. Now, did that happen in Santa Barbara when the law changed in 1986?
No. Same people, basically. People will drift in during the wintertime a little bit, but, you know, there was hardly any influx. If anything, they have gotten tougher just by, you know, having bicycle cops and getting you for throwing a cigarette butt down or just, you know, so they've gotten crazier, while really the influx of people really hasn't changed. They are so afraid that they're, you know, that something's going to happen, that people can sleep, you know, or people are going to gather, or people are going to come, or whatever, but you at least have to have the right to sleep. I mean, they can get you quotes for panhandling if they want. They can get you for doing open containers or whatever, but at night when the sun goes down and everyone else is sleeping in the world, that's, you know, that's the right of everyone to go to sleep.
Indeed, you would think that it's an unreasonable regulation of even if you claim that that you can regulate hours of panhandling or places of panhandling. For example, in Santa Cruz, it's illegal to peacefully ask for money after dark anywhere in the city. Although that law, as I have not yet heard of that specific provision being enforced, but it is on the books thanks to the Liberal City Council and its 1994 vote. Yet sleeping, one line of attack that's been suggested is that in Santa Cruz particularly, and I guess in Santa Barbara too, it's criminal to sleep in the nighttime hours. Because in 1989, even though you had writ your city council at the after a mass protest threat by Mitch Snyder and a great massive organizing by yourself and the Creative Community for Nonviolence and the Legal Defense Center and Will Hastings down there, and endless testimony from social service providers at city council meetings, great financial donations from Kit Tremaine, academic support from the University of California at Santa Barbara, and Rob Rosenthal and others. Writers like Peter Marin, support from media and national media, which was located at the Reagan White House at that time, and also support from Hollywood figures. You had some famous Hollywood people like Martin Sheen and Cher and so forth, who were actually showing up at your sleepouts.
Right.
You had all this going. There was a change in the sleeping law. For 3 years, it was legal to sleep on at least some public property in some areas. And then in 1989, a reactionary judge ruled that no, camping as a matter of definition includes the word sleeping, and therefore any form of sleeping is now a form of camping. And you then started a second sleepout at City Hall in 1990, perhaps similar to the 65-day-long sleepout we have here currently going on in Santa Cruz. What happened with that sleepout, Bob?
Well, it started out, well organized and with good intentions. But then after a while, people start, wearing down, and kind of it gets a little disorganized. Kind of at the very end of the sleep out, there weren't that many people, and then some of the more rowdy, aggressive people on the street kind of, were in the sleeping area there and kind of taking, bullying their ideas around. So it was quite difficult at the very end, but in the beginning, for the first couple months, it had a good spirit and all. At the end, it kind of petered out. But all in all, even the media kind of said, "Hey, it's a bunch of bums out here at City Hall." But all we were asking, "Hey, where can we sleep? Can we sleep?" It was a simple question. It's like
Now you were part of that sleepout yourself, right?
Right.
Were you there almost every night, or what was your situation?
I was probably there 75% of the time.
And did you receive tickets, and were you subject to arrest because of your actions there?
No, because they basically we could sleep there somewhat. They kind of let us do the demonstration because City Hall is a place where you can't come with grievances, so they kind of accepted that. But
so
there was a few people that they started putting signs up, and they got them for putting their foot on the City Hall steps and things like that.
Well, I understand there was a specific law that said what the can't.